It certainly ended up different than I thought it would. I thought he was going to pull the gun out and shoot him up like he always used to. But
I think he also sent a message to come over this year.
Yeah, natural environment, natural resources will come to order. First bill on the agenda is Senate File 692. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 692 is here for a reason that happened, I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, when...
Do you mind moving the microphone a little closer, Senator? I appreciate it.
A provision was put into one of the bills that restricted the native prairie restoration, the grasses that could be used to, they had to be purchased within a 25-mile area. And the provision, basically, that was put into law, restored native prairie means a restored restoration using at least 25 representative and biologically diverse native prairie plants species of a local type originating in the same county as the restoration site or within 25 miles of the county's border, but not across the boundary of an ecotype region. So what that did is in many of the restorations, whether it pertained to the same grass or not, we basically fenced out grass seed producers who raised the very grasses that could be used to do these restorations. And one of the examples that I recall a few years ago was when we had a lot of conservation reserve programs in northwestern Minnesota, and we had a series of counties up there, a number of counties that had fairly high percentage of their land to these programs. And they spelled out that a certain kind of a grass had to be used. And what happened is that it ended up costing farmers an enormous amount of money. And in some cases, they couldn't even meet the regulations because the availability wasn't there. And so what this legislation does is remove that restriction. It doesn't say that it has to be a different kind of a grass, but it does remove the miles or the mileage restriction, so that if you can purchase grass beyond that 25-mile limit. And in my estimation, and in the information that I've seen, is that it'll do a couple of things. One is that it'll allow those producers who are currently growing grass seeds to market their grass, their seed. And then the other one is that in some of the restorations, and one of them that occurred in Stearns County, on a 100-acre plot, a restoration plot, it cost an increased cost of $18,000 under the current law. So this is the language or the bill that we have before us is one that would maximize our dollars that go into those prairie restorations and make it a little bit less expensive to do them. Have some gentlemen and ladies here who are in the production of grass seed and can give you a little more of a thorough idea of the maybe they can address the differences or the lack of differences between those grasses and where they're grown. So.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity. Committee members, my name is Mike Ratzloff. I'm from Lake Bronson, the very northwest corner of the state. I'm here representing myself as a grower of native seed and also a Northern Seed Trade Association. And one of the handouts you should have received is a position paper from the Northern Seed Trade. I'll be talking to some of the points off of that paper. I'm here today to support the passing of SF 692, which repeals the statute that Senator Stumpf talked about. The restrictions the statute places on native seed and seed sourcing has a negative impact on businesses like ours and may actually hinder the further development of the grasslands by increasing the cost, as Senator Stumpf indicated. The Northern Seed Trade believes this statute, as it is written, does not have any scientific basis, places arbitrary limits on the seed movement. For example, just as one example I'd like to bring up, in the last 10 years, our business has been supplying native seed to grassland restorations throughout Minnesota. In 2008, there was a bill through the legislature. There was an approval of a wetland reserve program, RIM combination, where state and federal monies went together to enroll lands for wetland restorations for 10,000 acres. That statute, as it is written now, places all of the seed that we raise in a discouraged category. It is no longer acceptable for sourcing for most of those acres. Even though it's been proven to be very adapted, and it performs very well in all of those regions. And if you'd again refer to that NSTA position paper that you received, that example that Senator Stumpf talked about is at the bottom of that page in the cost increase. That was in 2007. I have two more examples I'm going to go through real quick. These are very recent examples. They're from Yellow Medicine County, and the other one is just southern Minnesota. I don't have a county for it. Using NRCS standards, which have been in place for many years, and they've been used over and over for many different restorations, they don't allow seed that is not adapted. They are set up based on adapted material. The cost for restoration for 1 acre would be $108 an acre for the seed. If we implement Minnesota Statute 84.02, the cost goes to $611 an acre. That's over a $500 an acre increase just in seed alone. The second example goes from $110 an acre to $420 an acre. And in addition to the increased cost, the availability of the seed is questionable. These things put together, we're going to end up getting less acres restored to prairie with the increased cost and shortage of seed. And all of this based on a statute that we believe does not have any scientific backing. Shortly after that statute was implemented, there was sequencing, they're calling it. They developed a sequencing process to try and still get the projects done. The sequencing process moved farther and farther away from the source of the project to get seed so they could keep searching the market to try and find the seed. And I want to read just a piece of that sequencing that the LCCMR is using for funding their projects. I quote, example, I-2, restoration in Pope County. Plant material may be from all of Pope County and within 25 miles to the west and south of Pope County, but not from within 25 miles to the north or east, because they cross a county landscape grouping based on ecological subsections developed by DNR. Does that make sense, that you can go 25 miles one direction and not 25 miles the other off a county line? These arbitrary definitions and limits are going to create unreasonable and unjustified rules to be inserted into state programs. Also in your handout, there should be a letter there from Nancy Jo Elke, who's a professor and department head at the University of Minnesota. I'm not a genetics expert, but as you can see from the handout, there's plenty of scientific research supporting the position of the Northern Seed Trade. We tried desperately to get the scientific community here to testify. Most of the people referenced in that paper are federal employees, and we were told they could not testify in a matter of state laws. so all we could do was bring their documentation. Nancy Jo Elke was scheduled to testify, but this hearing has coincided with her vacation. So in lieu of testimony, she submitted the letter that you've received. And I'd like to read just two sentences out of that letter.
I don't have that letter.
Front page, second paragraph.
Mr. Radcliffe, are there copies of the letter being passed out?
We're getting them.
They were provided.
Are they being passed out?
I haven't had it so far. It's not in this.
They were handed, yeah, they were given.
Yeah.
Well, I don't see her name.
Who's?
Ratsky?
Mr. Chairman, what was the name?
Oh, they should be up here.
What's the name?
This
is not
Ratsloff.
Oh, no, her name.
Nancy Jo Elke. It says University of Minnesota on the top.
Yeah, we have one, a University of Minnesota against you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, there's several pieces of information I think that's been handed out, some in opposition and some in support.
We have it now?
We found it. We'll pass it out. Let's pass it out before it's read.
Would you like me to read or wait till you get it?
Let's get a few passed out.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Nancy Jo Elke's letter, dated March 8th, second paragraph. I would like to address Statute 84.02, Subdivision 2, Best Management Practices for Native Prairie Restoration. By definition in the statute, this means using seed collected from a native prairie within the same county or within 25 miles of the county's border but do not cross the boundary of an ecotype region. This designation of best management practices is not supported by scientific research conducted by my research project, by researchers in neighboring states, or around the world. There is no credible evidence to support the use of local ecotype plant materials within a 25-mile radius to prevent the genetic contamination of local remnant prairies. And that's all I would like to read out of there. There's much more scientific information in that letter from Nancy. I could go into many other reasons from a business point of view that this statute would be negative, but I believe from the economic point of view and the scientific evidence, that speaks for itself. Effect on our business is a small thing compared to the scientific evidence and the cost to the state. Again, thank you for allowing me to testify, and please consider passing SF 692.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Mary Mueller, and I am not a seed grower. I've never been a seed grower, but I did ask to testify today, and I'm testifying on my own behalf. Mm-hmm. I wanted to testify because I have a long history of doing restoration work for our conservation programs. And there's a handout, I believe, coming around that I've got some pictures I'd like to go through. But I have a long history. And for about 10 years, from 1999 until 2007, I ran a small restoration business where I did work in about three counties in that very agricultural-rich part of the state, south central Minnesota. And prior to that, did restoration work for a local unit of government and a lot of work, volunteer work as well. It's something that I've spent a lot of time with. I've also worked a lot with our conservation programs that utilize the restoration standards. I was a Farm Bill specialist for a number of years and also worked for Soil and Water Conservation District back in the 80s when the first RIM program came out. And I've sat at a lot of kitchen tables with people trying to make the decisions about these conservation programs. And those programs are so integral to the agricultural part of the state. They are so meaningful in many ways. They provide a lot in terms of water quality benefits. Bowser and USGS are currently doing some research entitled Effects of Grassland Retirement in the Minnesota River Basin, and it's showing that as we add more grasslands back to our landscape, we're seeing increases in biotic integrity, and we're seeing less nitrate nitrogen in our streams. Wildlife response in these parts of the state are attributed to these conservation programs. And sitting with landowners on kitchen tables, I can attest that this is an important part of agricultural systems, both financially and ecologically. It gives choices for the less productive parts of the land. So I'm coming at this and asking you to support Senate File 692 because I'm afraid it will have some poor effects on our conservation programs. I wanted to provide a handout that I'll be referring to from time to time, but I want to start by saying scientific evidence. You know, there's been a lot of research about how far we can move plant materials, and honestly, there's a lot of conflict about that. But most of the research that I've looked at has either looked at moving it three or four states and then something very, very local and tried to compare them. But there hasn't been a lot of research on what is really the appropriate distance. And so the 25 miles, I don't believe has credible research behind it. I have not seen it if it exists. Another part of Minnesota Statute 8402 asks to use seed within ecologic sub-regions of the state, ecoregions, and I have a lot of concern about that process as well. I would like you to turn in the handout to the second page. This is a map that I put together. It was in McLeod County, and you see this blue area on the map. That's a piece of land that a conservation club that I belong to is hoping to buy and restore and open to public use. If you look around, this map was put together by our club in order to drum up some funds to buy that land. If you look at this piece of property, it's surrounded by wildlife management areas that already exist, and there's a number of new RIM WRPs that are going to be put in that were funded last year. And this land is very wet, very poorly drained land. And there's no commercially available seed source within 25 miles of any of the counties where I used to do restoration work. But if we look into the ecoregion for this project, we'd have to go into an ecoregion called the Anoka Sand Plains. Anoka Sand Plains is supposed to have more appropriate seed for a very wet piece of restoration land than wet, heavy soils within the Minnesota River Basin or other areas where that seed could be sourced. And those kinds of examples are all over the place. And so I really feel that as a person who used to buy seed for restorations and look for the most appropriate source, that this legislation is going to get in the way of that. I'd also like to point out that when I started doing restoration work for conservation programs in the 1980s, when we looked to do native plantings, the specs called for about 3 native grasses. That's as complicated as they got. And when we were looking for that seed in the 80s, we had to go out of state. We had to go to Kansas and Missouri to find the seed sources. And it was expensive. We thought terribly expensive in the 80s, $125, $150 an acre for the seed. Now, less than 25 years later, for that same $125, we can put together restorations with 25 species diversity with seed that originated in Minnesota using seed that's been developed by the nurseries. But we can't do it in 25 miles, and we can't do it in ecoregion. And I think there's going to take a lot of public money if you feel that we need to get to that point, because if we're going to have a fully diverse slot of seeds to do these restorations from each county, it's going to take a huge, huge influx of funds. And from my perspective, I think we could spend that better by having some good restoration programs and reasonable standards in which to enact them. So in conclusion, I ask you to support Senate File 692, and I ask you to support it so that we can have strong nurseries to rely on in order to do the restorations that are so important to our lands and our water quality. And just because I thought it would be fun, I put together a series of photos and the wildlife response to diverse seedings that were done prior to this law with seed that would no longer work on the restorations that you're seeing on the four picture page there. That land was all soybeans in 2003. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Mueller, could you just comment a little bit more in terms of the success of, you know, we can see the evidence here of seeds that's come from these areas and whether the sturdiness, if you will, or the hardiness for, through temperatures and so on that you've experienced, has it deteriorated? Does it deteriorate in the areas you've done, or is it... Do the plants kind of adapt to their new environment, or how does it go?
I spend a lot of time evaluating. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members. I spend a lot of time evaluating old seedings. Like I said, prior to doing this as a business, I did it as a conservation district employee. And the specs have changed so much. So when we go back and look at the stuff that we did 20 years ago, they don't have a lot of diversity, but honestly, we didn't plant that diversity to start with. You know, we had a spec that said three grasses, and so it's really unfair to go back and look at those 20-year-old seedings and say, well, we don't have any diversity in them. Of course we don't. We didn't plant them. Mm-hmm. When I started my seeding business by 1999, the specs had improved a lot, tremendous amount, and there was more room for more diversity. And when I go back and look at those seedings, a lot of times that diversity is still there if they were properly managed. And that's a huge, huge factor. It's, you know, a little difficult to always say we've lost species, because part of the reason can be from a lot of factors, but usually it boils down to that was sprayed to because of invasives like thistles. And so there's been some spraying that's gone on, and that's reduced the diversity. But the photos that I have here are on my own farm. I'm managing it myself, and I'm pretty picky about stuff like that. And, we struggle with management all the time. And we've had, at times, had to spray for thistles. And we'll go in and reintroduce the flowers back in, but that can't always be done. But when I've seen a reduction in diversity, it's mostly been on account of spraying. At least that's what I've attributed it to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Mueller, were you able to go through some of your academic background on this issue?
Mr. Chair, thank you. My academic background is I have a bachelor's degree in ecology, and during that coursework studied prairies and wetlands as sort of my specialties. My decision to go into the seeding business was partially because I was raising young children and wanted to be at home, and it was a way to stay involved in the programs that I love so much and be at home and be a mom. So I do have quite a bit of education and in this area, and I I spend a lot of time reading the literature, and I just find it interesting.
How long have you been doing that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Your restoration endeavors.
Yeah. First restoration that I was involved in was probably in 1985 as part of a class, outdoor classroom. And through the Soil and Water Conservation District for about 5 years. And a number of years I worked for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I wasn't doing restoration work at that time except for as a volunteer. It's sort of gotten in my blood. So I did quite a lot of volunteer work with a number of sportsmen's clubs that were doing restoration work as a business from 1999 until 2007. I'm no longer in that business.
Would you agree that it is important, number one, to have diversity in our native plantings?
I think it's one of the most important things that we can do to achieve our goals. I've had a strong feeling about diversity. When I was doing restoration work for our conservation programs, I've seen a lot of improvement in the specs. Most of the installation that I did, I went beyond the specs and tried to get more diversity into the seedings. It was probably a poor decision economically, but I enjoyed it. And I did find that even if it was more expensive, you could sell it to the landowner if you talked about why. My own experiments with it are empirical experiments. I've even gone out into diverse and non-diverse areas and just closed my eyes and listened, and honestly, you can hear the difference. There's so many more birds and so many more insects and less noisy animals where you have diverse seedings versus grasslands.
So it's important to be diverse. Would you agree that it's important for that diversity to be as locally located as possible, those seeds to come as close as possible to wherever you're planting? And that is not a yes and no question.
Yeah, maybe I know, I'm
maybe
thinking about it.
It depends, but
the diverse,
so whatever your answer is.
Yeah, when I've looked at doing diverse plans, the first thing I look at is the soils, to be honest with you. I look at the soils and then choose the plants that are going to perform well in those soils. The specs for our programs, you know, give you a recipe, so to say, of plants that you can use. I generally would split that between the wet soils and the drier soils because I knew those plants would perform well. So I've always felt it was more important to choose the appropriate plants and build the diversity within a budget than it was to make sure it was from the closest source. Seed growers are competitive businesses, and you can get better deals at some point from some than others. And I would prefer to buy something a little cheaper that's still appropriate. If it's not appropriate, I won't use it. I don't care how cheap it is. But if it's still appropriate and cheaper, I would prefer to have that flexibility to get the diversity in within the budgets, because there are limited budgets on these things. But you guys could, you know, do something about it if you wanted to. I'm kidding. But we have to work within the budgets, and that's part of the formula. And the closest source, you know, if I'm not a seed grower, but if I were and you insisted on closest source, that would get a lot more expensive.
Can you rank the importance for us? And I don't know about this area, so that's why I'm asking. It may be an off-the-wall question. Can you rank the importance of that? You mentioned soils. Is it soils, diversity, and then source of the seed? Or is that the wrong question?
Yeah, well, no, it's a good question. You know, in doing a plan, you know, it's always within a budget. So the first thing, like I said, is appropriate species for the land. And if I had a limited budget and I had to choose between a closest source and an appropriate source but more variety that might be further away, I would, or more diversity, I'd choose the diversity every time. I just don't think it's going to be economically feasible to have truly diverse plant seed sources in very limited geographic areas.
I don't know if you're the right person to ask this question to. Maybe there are other witnesses. What are the general nature? What's the general geographic nature of our prairies? Obviously, it's not just our geographic borders. Where are they all kind of just kind of the same type? Is there a same type for northern Minnesota versus southern, or is it all kind of the same? Are there different types?
I can't answer that definitively for you. I do spend a lot of time hiking different prairies throughout the state, and what I've seen is as the soils change, so do the prairie species, and even maybe how those species look on the top of the hill versus the wet edges if they happen to be tolerant of all those areas. But I cannot, I'm not qualified
maybe
to talk
else,
about prairie
maybe
biomes.
Someone else has a thought on that. Mm-hmm. Anything else you wanted to mention? Any other questions for Ms. Mueller? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Dennis Peterson. I live and work for Pheasants Forever near Montevideo, Minnesota. I've been with the organization for 7 years. I don't have any educational background in this stuff. I'm a practitioner. I'm a guy on the tractor with a drill, putting the seed in the ground, running a drip torch. But I pay a lot of attention to this kind of stuff, and the way I've accumulated my knowledge is through practical experience and through exposure to lots of people who are very smart and well-educated on the topic. And what I want to give you today is the Pheasants Forever view of this subject. We're dedicated to the conservation of wildlife habitat through programs, public awareness, education, and land management policies. And we pursue that mission in Minnesota nationwide, but in Minnesota with the enthusiastic support and volunteer service of 76 local chapters, about 27,000 members, and a state staff of 8 dedicated professional people, and our national organization headquarters in White Bear Lake. And I'm here today to support Senate File 692 as a necessary step to correct what we believe is the overly restrictive language contained in Minnesota Statute 8402 as it pertains to native seed and native seed sources used for restoration work in the state. We're not in the business of growing or producing seed. We don't harvest it off of native prairie remnants. We don't do any research on plant biology. We don't do any selection and testing. We're practitioners. We use the native grass and wildflower seed that's produced by the industry here in the state to do restoration work, thousands and thousands of acres in Minnesota over the last 10 years alone. We plant, develop, and manage grassland habitat. And we raise money that we use to acquire land from willing sellers, which is then converted into permanent habitat, which is almost always open to public hunting. We are very supportive of increased species diversity and restoration programs and of programs that protect our remnant prairies through easements and acquisitions. But we share the view that the seed sourcing restrictions contained in 8402, as well-intentioned as they may be, are at best highly debatable, that they have no apparent scientific validity, and they do not give full consideration to the resource implications and the practical limitations that result from its broad application. We believe that these restrictions adversely affect the ability of our organization and our partners to put seed into the ground and restore habitat. It's not our purpose to debate the science, but just as a way of pointing out that there's a lot of contention, I want to quote a couple of examples. Dwight Tober, who's a well-known plant materials specialist at the Plant Materials Center in Bismarck, North Dakota, notes what is self-evident. In nature, plant selection is an ongoing ecological process, and whenever seed is harvested from any source, plant selection is occurring. In other words, even if seed is being harvested from an existing native prairie remnant, the supposed purest of the pure, as soon as you take a subset of that seed and plant it someplace else, the plant characteristics are going to be affected, and the very things that 8402 portends to preserve will change. Plant geneticist Michael Kassler at the USDA Ag Research Station in Madison, Wisconsin, in a test that sampled the DNA from 75 naturally occurring switchgrass plants from throughout the Midwest, found that while origin is important, seeds can be transferred widely within the hardiness zone in which they originated. He also found that plants from individual populations were as variable as those from geographically distant populations, and that remnant populations were very similar to cultivars. Cultivars are typically a dirty word when you get into the 8402 world. MS-8402 restrictions ignore these findings and others like them. Beyond the science, 8402 imposes a regime that can only serve to dramatically increase the cost, making it less attractive to private landowners and much less affordable for the state. We commonly spend $125 to $200 per acre for diverse plantings of Minnesota native grass and wildflower seed using seed grown from collections taken on prairie remnants all over Minnesota and just across the border into neighboring states. We can easily envision that prices for seed acquired under 8402 distance limitations would be orders of magnitude more expensive. MS-8402 gives little consideration to the practical realities of seed production. The quantity and the quality of seed required is not going to be accumulated by annual harvest of native prairie remnants, except to the extent that it provides original parent material. Seed to plant most conservation land in the state, even on today's scale, is grown in production plots, be they large or small, the work of a mom-and-pop operation or a big producer. As a natural resource program, as the rules exist today, almost all grassland plantings that are funded with state dollars are supposed to comply with 8402. And certainly some such seed is available, but in very limited areas and in very limited quantities. Even with a major resource commitment, production sufficient to serve all areas of the state and the quantities required cannot be ramped up for a number of years. And without a reliable, stable market, it is not likely ever to be produced. The logical implication is that the activities to which 8402 applies will come to a standstill until seed is available. We are very concerned that as we respond to land use pressure changes, which are reducing grassland habitat, roadblocks should not be placed in the way of important ongoing habitat restoration activity. And the narrowly focused and debatable technical restrictions contained in 8402 are such roadblocks. Speaking as a wildlife habitat organization and one concerned with possibly the largest number of acres affected by 8402, we believe it is not the definitions themselves, per se, that are the problem, but overly restrictive geographic and distance limitations. Let there be no doubt that we support the use of local ecotype and Minnesota native seed whenever and wherever it is practical, cost-effective, and reasonable to do so. But we find that the broader geographic sourcing guidelines contained in Minnesota NRCS technical specifications, and as they are practiced by most native plant professionals, are arguably better suited to accomplish broadly based habitat objectives and to protect most resource interests. We support 692 as a necessary step to preclude the adverse impacts that we think will result from continuing the restrictions imposed by 8402. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. I made a couple notes when you were questioning Mary. I would echo everything that she said. I would also add, in response to the question about how important that this is, it diversity that's most important, or is it the close sourcing that's important? The context in which you're doing the planting and the objectives of the particular program that you're trying to satisfy, and the local habitat, what's already on the landscape already, those are also important considerations when you're trying to sort seed. And I guess the last extemporaneous comment I would add is that seed mix development, to me at least, is an art. There's a lot of science involved in it, perhaps, but it is an art as much as anything else. And hard and fast rules don't lend themselves well to that art. and I'll take any questions you might have.
What are the NRCS guidelines that you were talking about?
The NRCS guidelines that were...
First of all, what is the NRCS?
NRCS is the technical arm of United States Department of Agriculture. NRCS stands for Natural Resource Conservation Service. You may know it under its former name of Soil Conservation Service. NRCS develops most of the technical parameters for USDA conservation programs. And their standard for, which is applied generally, things I work with, to CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program, WRP, Wetlands Reserve Program, sometimes to CREP, Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. They encourage the use of highly diverse natives wherever and local ecotype if it's available. But cultivars are acceptable. They have a list of approved cultivars that can be planted, and that applies mostly to the grasses, not to the wildflowers so much. But the distance limitation that they impose, or that they recommend, the guideline for local ecotype seed is 200 miles from the planting site.
Why is that?
To the best of my knowledge, it's a distance limitation or a recommendation that's generally accepted in that community.
The general nature of a prairie, is that basically within a 200-mile span? Is that why it's there, or? This goes back to my question before of where is a what are the general geographic how long how big is the expanse of the Minnesota prairie type, for example? Does it go from northern Iowa to South Dakota, crosses over Minnesota? What are we looking at of the type of prairie that we have in Minnesota?
Our prairie generally falls into the category of what's called the tall grass prairie. And that prairie, pre-European settlement, stretched from Manitoba to Texas, north and south, and westward slightly into South Dakota, and east at least to Ohio and Illinois, perhaps. And I'm on a little bit of dangerous ground here because I'm not technically qualified, but I read a lot. And that tall grass prairie was composed of what are called generalist species, and those were well distributed throughout the entire tall grass prairie. The characteristics of a big blue stem that grew in northern Minnesota or Bismarck might have been different, probably was different from something that grew in Iowa or farther south, but you know, it was still a big blue stem. There are other plants, wildflowers in particular, that have, within the tall grass prairie region, have narrower distribution backgrounds. So you've got generalists that were very widespread, and then there's a word for it, and I can't remember what it is. There are specialists that were not distributed nearly as widely. But back when, the prairie stretched a long way. And I would maintain that the premise behind some of these things is somewhat flawed, in that it seems to me the premise is that there are these little pockets of genetic difference and genetic purity that are scattered around the landscape in 25-mile circles. And I would submit that if that is true, it's due more to the fragmentation that's occurred on the landscape over the last 150 years since European settlement than it is to the conditions that existed pre-European settlement, when the bison, the bees, and the birds and the spread the seed from place to place as they traveled. And the extent of my reading is that the 200-mile, I think it's 200 miles south and 150 miles north and perhaps 1,000 feet of elevation change east and west provide a good basis for adaptability, for the generalists at least.
What about 25 miles from a county border? What kind of accuracy or specialization will you get with that?
Boy, I'm really getting on dangerous ground now. I'm giving you strictly opinion.
This is all we're asking for, is your opinion.
Some of these distance limitations are very, very arbitrary. I was in a meeting this morning with a number of highly trained professional people discussing seed mix development for MnDOT. They're trying to come up with a manual to help put seed mixes together. And one of the Minnesota programs, DNR programs, that has the most restrictive requirements is the SNA program. And the seed for that program technically is supposed to originate within 25 miles. That 25-mile number was acknowledged in the meeting this morning to be not based in any kind of science, but just an informed opinion about what might be a safe number to use. So I don't personally think that there is any legitimacy to that.
Senator Anderson, you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm sitting here with five other scientists who have a different opinion from the one that you've presented, Senator Stumpf. And, you know, it's a little hard for us as a committee to decide which scientists are right. But I did ask for some opinions on this from people that are presumed to be experts who have read peer-reviewed studies, and a lot of them have very different opinions about this. So I think it's hard for us as a committee to really decide what's the right science here when we have competing scientific theories. But let me just ask a question or two about this, because even if there is a difference of opinion, it seems to me that we could maybe figure out how to work that out. But this bill is really what you're trying to do, Senator Stumpf. It seems to me goes beyond trying to work out what's a reasonable definition, because this just repeals the definitions. This current law that you want to repeal doesn't actually require anything to happen. If we repeal it, it just says we won't have definitions in law anymore of what best management practices for native prairie restoration is. And instead, you'll follow whatever standards you think are appropriate, I believe, and that would be NRCS or whatever the grower or the restorer would believe is appropriate. And so I wonder, it seems to me at a minimum there should be a middle ground here, that there should be some standards that we know we're going to get.
That's a fair question. Minus the statute, what standards for distance from where you're going to get the seeds would be used? Would there be a requirement, or would there would just be kind of individual choice? Would it be the NRCS standards, or would it just be anything else, arbitrary?
Mr. Chair, if I may address that.
Mueller.
Thank you. All programs that are funded through Bowser that have any tie with the federal programs utilize NRCS standards. And those standards, there are different standards for different types of projects, and the standard most often used for wildlife-type projects is a standard that requires a minimum of 15 species to be originated within 200 miles of the restoration site. That is the standard used for those programs right now. I am not aware of what DNR does, although I do believe they have standards for their programs, but I don't know.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Thank you. Well, we need to know what the other standards are in law, and I think that this would only apply if we're talking about spending public money. But it seems to me more important than that really is the issue of what these definitions are about native prairies. And I'm sitting here thinking, okay, why do we want to preserve native prairies as opposed to prairies in general? Because I know, Ms. Mueller, you restore prairies beautifully. And I've seen your photos, and they're beautiful. But the question is, you know, we have less than 1% of our native prairies left, and should we have a special standard in place for the native prairie remnants? That's what I think this is about, and that's where I would disagree with you, that There's lots and lots of land restoration that's going to be done around the state and has been done around the state through RIM and CREP and other programs. And probably the standards that you're talking about are appropriate for those. But native prairie, we have less than 1% left. And I think the reason we want to protect it and preserve it is because it has unique species on those native prairie remnants that don't exist anywhere else. And if they're gone, they're gone. And so that concerns me that we're just going to say it says right in this definition, native prairie means land that has never been plowed, or if it was disturbed, it's still predominantly covered with that native prairie vegetation. And so it seems to me that we need to have the highest possible standards for protecting the genetic diversity that exists on those native prairies. And I don't know if 25 miles is the magic number. I think we could have a good dialogue and discussion about that. But it also, the scientists that have given their opinions today agree, it seems for the most part, except for the one that you presented, the other ones, that when you, the further away you go, the more likely that you could change the strength of that those native species, that if you mix them with other species, they could weaken their ability to reproduce, and you could weaken diversity eventually and lose some of the species. And so I think our native prairie efforts should be really specifically focused on maintaining those native species. And so I'm concerned, Senator Stumpf, that if you repeal this law, we'll lose that whole purpose of why should we put money into protecting native prairies when we're not going to try to use the most native species with the most integrity being as close as they can from that location.
Senator Olson, excuse me, Senator Stumpf, did you have a response?
Mr. Chairman, I think several issues that Senator Anderson brings up, but one of them is that the Finance Committee just passed out a bonding bill, mm-hmm. and in that bonding bill, there's $29 million for projects that would impact the flood mitigation and a number of other programs across the state. That all gets picked up under the 84A.02. It doesn't say native restorations. It just says it says prairie restorations. And so I think the part of the problem is that 2 years ago, before this actually became law or before this provision was put in place, we did have standards. And the standards were NRCS or they were DNR or they were Department of MnDOT. Those standards are still there. It's not as if the state's going to be operating without standards. It's just that for many of the projects that occur, we either are going to operate under this provision, 84A.02, and spend several times more money, maybe extra $100 or $200 per acre or whatever, to try to comply. And in the testimony that I heard from Ms. Mueller was that in many cases, we couldn't even comply if we wanted to. Those projects could not move forward because the seed isn't available. And so I think there are reasons for probably what you're saying in terms of the native grasses, maybe in some areas, but this law that we have currently picks everything up, period.
Well, just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. This law doesn't actually do anything except create definitions. It's whether we refer to it in other places.
Correct.
As far as I understand. And so I think that repealing this is like kind of like using a sledgehammer to whack a mosquito. Because if you're concerned about whether all those public dollars should be tied to these definitions, that's really a different question. I don't think we should repeal the definitions. I think we can quibble about whether we should apply these definitions to every restoration project around the state. And I think in that bonding language, it says, you know, to the extent possible. It doesn't say if you can't find it, these local seeds, then the project doesn't happen. It says you got to try to get as close to these standards as you can. And if you can't do it, then you can go further. So just want to be
We're still back
that.
To whether these standards are appropriate. I have Olson, Dibble, and then Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem with attempting to preserve native prairie. But once it's been used for something else for a long period of time, you're not going to bring back native prairie. Native prairie is native prairie. And obviously preserving those seed types and things, I think, is a value. But in restoring and trying to bring back prairie, I appreciated the common sense that I heard. I heard two things that were, I think, the basic standards for making something work. Because I think the test is if you have a seed that will, number one, grow in the soil type and stand up in terms of hardiness, in terms of where the region in which it's used. And those hardiness regions have shifted over time. I mean, we talk about climate change. That's been going on for a long time, and there are shifts in those. So I think common sense says that if you're going to make your investment in this work, you're going to choose seeds that are appropriate to soil types, as I heard Ms. Mueller say, and I heard from Mr. Peterson, the hardiness issue is critical to this, so that you can get, you know, restoring a prairie. It's not going to be native, and I don't know how we could expect it to be native, because I don't know how you do that. Things have changed over the years, but if we can preserve elements of native to, you know, look to, and maybe there is some infiltration in of more depending on which is more hardy and will stand up to it. But I don't see the value in our getting this down to the a very narrow restriction that actually will prohibit the really good goals of reestablishing some prairie and habitat for the things that we value. So I'm in support of your legislation, and I appreciate your testimony.
Senator Dibble.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sounds like we might be coming to some agreements. You know, I think we're honing in on some distinction between we have, you know, restored native prairie and restored prairie definitions, and some question about when to apply those things. I find myself very ill-equipped to make a decision here today with, you know, five letters that say one thing and a couple letters that say 180 degrees, something different. So I find myself struggling and completely ill-equipped to make a determination. But I find myself, just by the conversation, persuaded that, you know, there may be some merit to, you know, to honing in on that distinction, restored native prairie, where we're trying to preserve something fairly pristine but needs a little help making it more pristine. Although I do wonder why we restore native prairies if they've never been disturbed, but it's another conversation for another time. And this restored prairie idea, which I think Senator Olson is talking about. It sounds like they're trying to hone in on the ecotype within the restored prairie, the ecotype region, but the 25-mile restriction is loosened up a little bit. I also, Mr. Chair, I'm reflecting on Bowser having brought forward a couple of ideas recently to create some recognition when it's hard to source seed from a particular area for, you know, looking for some ability to create some alternative approaches to that. So they've clearly indicated to us that they're running into some economic or practical difficulty doing what they need to do with these kinds of restrictions. So all this is a long-winded way of saying I think an outright repeal may be a little heavy-handed at this time, but, you know, it's definitely an issue opened up that's worthy of conversation.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, as I say, you're thinking about seeds and the environment. It just seems to me that in this watershed that we're in, the Mississippi watershed, and with the Red River Valley watershed that you've got up in your area, Senator Stump, there's a very easy potential for seeds to travel very long distances. And in that whole watershed that you're in, it's very conceivable that the Native Prairie is shedding seed in the southern part of your watershed and it's being carried by your floodwaters all the way into Canada on a regular basis. And as it's spread out over the floodplain, it's being dropped off as the floodwaters recede. And I can imagine that the genetic diversity of those seeds are probably not very diverse because of that flooding that spreads across the valley on a regular basis. And if you happen to be on the other side of the Continental Divide and the water is going south down the Minnesota River or some other river headed for the Mississippi, I can imagine those seeds are going a long ways down the Mississippi. And when they get to a floodplain further south and the waters recede, the seeds drop out and grow. And I'm not sure about transport of seed by animals. I imagine in some cases the seed gets caught in their feathers or in their hair and it's transported long distances. I do know that when a bovine animal eats roughage, it takes about 7 days for the product to get entirely through the system. Some of it's going to start making its way through and be deposited in as short as 48 hours, but some of it takes at least a 7 days to get through the system. And I'm not sure if the germination rate is very good on the seeds that's been in the system that long, but it's certainly a bovine animal can travel a long distance in 2 days or 7 days and transport that seed quite a way. So this whole idea of diversity of seeds and the importance of it, I'm not sure that that's really was even the case as the prairies developed 10,000 years ago. You've got the winds that can blow seeds around and native people may have carried them long distances in their travels as well. So just as I think about the mechanics of seed transfer, it seems to me that maybe this is being overemphasized and that your bill is appropriate, Senator Stump.
Mr.
Chair. Senator Engelbrecht and then Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the standards of NRCS has, how big of a radius do they use along with the DNR? I understand that's quite a bit larger than 25 miles.
200 miles.
Minnesota NRCS, typically the standard is 200 miles from the place you're planting.
That's certainly, excuse me, follow up. That seems to be working out fine for them.
Peterson.
I don't want to speak for NRCS, but I think so. That's been their standard for quite some time.
Senator Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, Senator Dale, I'm not a farmer, but I'm a gardener, and I know that a plant that may be native to one location, if you plant it in your garden and it's not from there, it can become invasive in a different setting. I mean, just because a plant is hardy and will grow somewhere doesn't mean it's suitable to go there. And you know that, obviously. That's kind of common sense. And Senator Dill, I agree with you in a native system where you had, you know, pre-settlement, seeds moved all over the place. But I think what we're talking about is, do we have any concern about maintaining that little tiny bit of native prairie that exists on the landscape that's surrounded by land that has been changed? And if we want to protect that, I mean, is that something we value as a state? I would assume it is, but I'm not hearing if the damage that would be done to those native prairie locations if you don't have these standards in place. That concerns me a lot. And I guess, Senator Stump, I would ask you how we would make sure that those places, the genetic diversity of those remaining small remnants would be preserved if you can get the seeds from far away from those spots.
I think we've been waiting for some information on how the current law would do what you're saying we value, which I think we do. And I think that's the question here, is whether the current law accomplishes what that value is. And I'm looking for some science that supports that. I do encourage members to look at the information that letters that Senator Anderson put out. One is from the Chicago Botanical Garden.
not sure what work they do. I presume it's on this issue. And one is from the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior, University of Minnesota. I did read these, and I don't see anywhere where they state that a 25-mile standard from a county border is supported by science. The closest the statement, one of the statements gets, is from Professor Shaw, that the 25-mile restriction is a sound compromise. That's the closest we get. And she goes further to say that they are working to launch a comprehensive investigation of the geographic scale of local adaptation for many more species. So I encourage members to look at these letters, all of them, and reach judgment, but I don't see where any of these letters are stating that the current standard is supported by science and will accomplish what we value for native diversity. There is a letter from Dr. Elke, Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, that says there is the current standards in law are not supported by scientific research. And she has conducted research, or her researchers, in neighboring states around the world, and that there is no credible evidence to support the use of local ecotype plant materials within a 25-mile radius. Now, I think the NRC standards, I think there's agreement, even amongst the scientific community, that it should be close as possible. But how we reached a scientific decision that 25 miles was the appropriate closeness, when the testimony we heard is that our native prairie spans from Manitoba to Texas, is difficult to assess, and I would like to hear that information. And honestly, that's kind of been the quandary that we've been facing since the law was passed in 07. This has only been 2 years old. This is not a long-established standard for Minnesota. And when we ask, what's the science behind this standard, the 25 miles and the counties altogether, what is a local ecotype in Minnesota? We don't come up with an answer. And so I think it is a correct statement to say that we should be uncomfortable as policymakers determining that science, particularly when, at the very least, there is disagreement, when there has been a longstanding standard of the 200-mile ecotype. And maybe that's not appropriate. Maybe we've become wiser. Maybe our science has gotten better. But if we're going to change that, we need to show it. We need to show that science. And it needs to be shown that it can be balanced, as science always is balanced, with the practicalities. Because we, in the end, we want to restore native prairies. And why would we not? Why would we want to restrict that? I would rather have a prairie for flood mitigation than a dike. And so if we've gotten wise enough to say we can mitigate floods or restore prairies, and we've gotten people on board with this finally, we should at least have, I think it's fair to request science on the specific standards if it's going to be written into statute. And that's kind of what has been a little bit confounding to me. And I know Representative Wagenius was a strong proponent of this law. I voted for this in conference committee where it was presented. But that was a mistake. The facts have seemed to show that we can't find where the basis was for this. So let's find the basis. But until then, let's not restrict conservation practices that are finally gaining momentum in our state. And I think that's reasonable. And I think we should, maybe there should be a working group on figuring out what the appropriate diversity and local standard should be. And then maybe it should be implemented by rule, by the technicians, or maybe a statute. But I think the current law has created problems. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're absolutely right that all the letters that we have I don't know where this 25 miles came from. And we don't know if that's scientifically supported. I think I'm noticing that not one scientist has testified today. And so all we've heard from is the advocates for who want to get rid of these standards. And so I feel really uncomfortable making a decision without having some science in front of us. A lot of letters is helpful, but only to a certain extent. And I agree with you. None of them say that this is the exact standard that it should be, although they do all say that you should use seed of the local ecotype for restoration. Maybe that's what we should put into this law. Maybe we should just take out the 25 miles. But it seems to me that repealing the whole law, like I said, is a little bit of an excessive approach to a problem that's been identified by one group of people, but not mm-hmm. necessarily with full information in front of us about what the advantages to this law are. I don't think we haven't really had any testimony from anybody who supports this.
We'll see if there's an additional testimony.
There may not be here today, though, Mr. Chair, so I guess I would urge us not to just make a quick decision. I agree with you that I think having a working group or some kind of way to get more of a consensus would be valuable rather than it sort of being all or nothing, which it seems to me are the options in front of us right now. Mr. Chairman?
Keep in mind, we didn't even have this information in front of us when the law was passed.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stumpf?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Elke would be happy to have been here, but her schedule just didn't allow it. And I've worked with Dr. Elke. She's a very well-respected, nationally respected doctor that works over at the University of Minnesota in breeding grass seeds. And I know she would be happy to come and lend any, answer any questions or lend any testimony.
Senator Kelosh, you had your hand up earlier.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think that a lot of this is these standards are great ideals, but I'm not sure they're practical in the terms of trying to get broad grasslands covered and put into use for restoration purposes. And I think the goal of getting native prairie has been long past, because anything that's plowed up is no longer native prairie, and doing the restoration. I also believe that there's going to be there's a certain group of people that will always be working to try to get native prairie, and as those and more diversity in their grasslands, such as Ms. Muller did. But I think that this is a case of ideal versus practical, and so I'm going to support Senator Stump's bill.
Senator Anderson, then we'll see if there's any additional folks who want to testify.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kelosh, I just want to clarify that I don't think you need to repeal this law to solve the problem that you're talking about. You're talking about for a wide practices of restoration, maybe we shouldn't use these standards. Well, that's different from having some standards for the best practices. If you think that we shouldn't have this level of specificity for all of our restoration programs, then we can say that, but that's not what's in this law. This law doesn't dictate anything about any restorations and any public dollars. All these are our definitions. And so the question is whether we're going to apply them, these standards, like in the bonding bill. I mean, I think that's where you should target your concern, is whether we should say that all those bonding dollars have to follow these standards rather than getting rid of definitions in law. But that's really two different things. Mr. Chair, I wonder if you'd consider just laying this bill over and trying to get your scientist that you mentioned, Dr. Helke, and see if there's another one who could come who could provide an alternative, or if there's any experts who have actually tried to do this and can is there anyone who's been successful at following the standards? I don't know if they are doable or not, but it makes me nervous just kind of to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Senator Stumpf, did you have any additional witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, no. Those are the that's all.
Does anyone want to testify in opposition to the bill?
Mr. Chairman?
I think while anyone's thinking about it or approaching, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an example of when we try to do by law get into some very definitive kinds of directives. And actually, we are setting standards by the definitions. Because the definition of the restored native prairie and restored prairie, they're restored native prairie, it's got the 25 miles, and you've got you've got to have at least 25, and you may not have 25 available. Should that stop us from going forward? This is, it seems to me that the federal standards allow for some flexibility for good professionals, which I believe we have both in terms of the agencies. If we are contributing money toward restoring, those kind of guidelines are available, and people that are interested in doing this want to get it as close to the diversity. They have the objectives that are in common with our values as well. Why do we need to micromanage this by statute? I have not heard or of anybody reporting that somebody's out there trying to muck this up with some oddball species and thinking that it's going to do the job and become a prairie. You're all reading the science and sorting things out and trying to develop best practices in the process of doing it, rather than for us to try to spend time pooling, in many cases, our ignorance to try to set, to get the specific things. We all come with bits of knowledge, and I'm not trying to belittle anybody in this, but we also come with our ignorances as well. And just because we got elected doesn't always necessarily give us that. We had wonderful learning experiences here, and we benefit from the things that you share and other professionals bring. But I think we shouldn't feel that somehow we have to control everything, whether it's by definition or whatever. And yet, I think there's a great deal of commitment and common values of what we want to achieve, and we shouldn't do things that are going to prevent that from happening.
I should add that the two Bowser agency bills, they have requested in their agency bills to use alternative methods in approaching this standard. And the testimony was is that it's been difficult. It's been difficult. Senator Scholl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate File 692 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
So persuasive.
It's tough.
What's that?
So she and I are so persuasive.
You probably don't have as much rural
Sir Saxon.
Yep. City folk, we appreciate your commitment.
We call those weedy lawns.
it's the NRCS standards.
Good about confining our livelihood to the committee, not so much in the House. Although I'm sure there'll be some discussion. Senate File 121, Senator Saxhawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an A2 amendment that I'd like to move.
The amendment is in our packets. Oh, I guess not. We'll pass it out.
It isn't? I thought.
the author's amendment, or is this the first stop bill has had?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right. So Senator Saxog moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Mr. Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 121 is amended as a bill relating to school trust funds. And before I turn it over to Kathy Lewis from the DNR Division of Lands and Minerals for a few remarks, I thought I'd make just very few myself. One, I think we all understand that there used to be 8 million acres of school trust lands. Right now we're down to 2.5 of the original acres. 90% of those are in north central and northeastern Minnesota, and it's and I think we know that those are both valuable for industry, recreation, habitat, and certainly for income for our schools. Recent legislation last year and in the Senate led by Senator Lynch, of course, changes things for us. It allows us to take the interest from trust fund and rather than supplant the general fund or the education fund as was done previously, now to supplement. So I think it becomes more and more important that we manage these lands in an effective way. You know, taking probably the most obvious, at some point we have 100,000 acres of school trust lands that are in the middle of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area doesn't necessarily need our school trust lands. I think there's ways that we can work on that. So this bill is just a small step. It has some of the low-hanging fruit that I think we think and the DNR thinks we can do to help manage our school trust lands more effectively. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Lewis.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals, Department of Natural Resources. The first two sections of the bill, as amended, concern the water crossing license and land crossing license. Minnesota Statute 84.415 authorizes the commissioner to issue licenses to utility companies when they cross public lands and public waters. The DNR issues about 200 water crossing licenses a year and about 30 land crossing licenses, and they're 50-year agreements in most cases, though they can be for 25 years. There's an application fee under the rules, which is $500, and that money goes to the general fund to pay for the cost of issuing the license, our staff cost. There's a water crossing fee and a land crossing fee also specified in the rules, and the rates, the payment, it goes to the land class for which the land belongs. For water crossing licenses, the water crossing fee has been going to the forest suspense account schools. That means that the money first goes into that account. The forestry has money going into that account from their timber management and also from real estate activities. And then their costs are certified against the forest suspense account. And the net proceeds goes into the permanent school fund. One of the amendments in this bill would provide that the money, the water crossing fee, would go directly into the corpus of the permanent school fund rather than going to the forest suspense account. They also have incorporated into this bill through the amendment the language that is appearing also in the governor's budget bill. And the governor's budget bill is identifying that we should be recovering our full costs for issuing utility licenses. And so the there's additional fees being proposed in the governor's budget bill that's being incorporated into this bill. So there will be supplemental application fees and monitoring fees, and those fees would be appropriated to the DNR for their costs for issuing the licenses. Section 2 of the bill, which is now Section 3, Section 2 of the original bill, is a different topic, and that's the land exchange law. Land being exchanged that the state owns goes through a process of valuation and approval by the Land Exchange Board. The Land Exchange Board is the governor, attorney general, and state auditor. Class A land under the land exchange laws are lands that are under the control of the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Class A lands are school lands, university lands, consolidated conservation lands, and lands. The lands must be in equal value for a land exchange, but they also have an additional restriction which is being addressed by this bill. When we're doing lands that are riparian, land exchange laws currently require that you exchange riparian for riparian, and that the riparian lands have to be in the same general vicinity, providing the public equal opportunity for access and water activity. Actually, for school trust lands, exchanging riparian for riparian can actually decrease your potential for revenue generation because of the setbacks that are required. So what this law would do would eliminate that riparian for riparian requirement for Class A lands, and thus providing some further opportunities for revenue generation for school trust lands.
So Ms. Lewis, Mr. Chair, Ms. Lewis, would that mean then so that if right now a school trust land was in a piece of lake shore or something like that, that you could trade it for a good piece of forest land, for instance?
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair,
or you couldn't before, is that?
Members of the committee, that is correct, that you can take and look at particularly. We always want to do land exchanges in the best interest of the trust, and this would further aid that activity so that you could be trading a parcel that is riparian, forest parcel as an example, for the potential to generate revenue for the trust.
I just used the word die.
So you're creating a fee, an additional fee in this bill? Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, there are additional fees being created in this bill, and that's in Section 2 of the bill as amended.
That's why I did it in the original bill.
And those new fees will be deposited into the school trust fund, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the supplemental application fee and the monitoring fee are for the cost of the DNR for issuing the license. And so they would actually be appropriated to the DNR for our cost. And when you see the governor's budget bill, you will see that there is a general fund revenue reduction for the funding for the Lands and Minerals Division of the DNR. And so part of the recovery of some of that funding is to increase fees for utility licenses. There's also an increase in fees for road easements being proposed.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chairman, does this have any impact on the management? You know, there's a deduction for operating the operations in DNR that involve with managing like forest lands and others. Will these fees help to reduce that? If you're replacing general fund, will it have any impact on the amount that you take from the income that would normally go into the trust?
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, the First Amendment, which you see on lines 13 and 14 of the bill as amended, would say that the money that would be going to the forest suspense account would not be going there any longer. And so the forest management could not be certifying cost against that revenue. But if you look at the reality, forestry was not managing the water crossing license. There's not trees growing in the water. So that's why it seems to be illogical for the benefit of the trust not to do that. The fees that you see in Section 2 of the bill are addressing the costs that are being incurred by Lands and Minerals Division for issuing the license and for monitoring the construction activity. So that also does not have an impact toward the forestry cost.
Yes, it's already here.
Senator Dill and then Senator Saxog.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just so I understand this a little better, if maybe I don't catch it exactly, but I'm looking here at the amendment on line 1.20 and reading down, and it looks like if you're crossing public waters or public lands, you wind up with a $6,000 bill. And does it make any difference whether it's just a short distance or a long distance across these public lands? If it's a quarter mile or a half mile or 2 miles or 10 miles, does it make any difference on the fee? And then I see on line 1.20, it's as an addition to application fees and utility crossing fees specified in Minnesota rules. So that means there's some more fees on top of what you've got listed here. So what are those fees? So what is the total cost for, say, a public utility to get across public land with all these fees? and how do the public utilities feel about it?
Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, there is currently a $500 application fee per license, and that's provided deposit in the general fund to cover cost for issuing the license. There is also a one-time water crossing fee or a land crossing fee. They are rates that are specified in rules that were adopted through the administrative procedure process. And a few years back, we came to the legislature and said the fees haven't kept up with the economy and the inflation. We asked for increased fees. The legislature looked at that issue. Some of the utility companies had quite a lobbying effort on that. So we didn't get all of that. We advocated for catching up with the economy, but the rates were increased at that time for these one-time fees. What we're doing here is we're adding one-time fees on top of those. So there would be supplemental application fee for a water crossing license of $1,500. So their application, total application fee would be $2,000 per water crossing license. And then they would have a one-time crossing payment, which is based from the rules, and that is based on the length of the length of the crossing and the width. And then they would also have a monitoring fee for us monitoring the construction. For a land crossing license, the application fee would be $5,000, and their one-time payment is a base rate, and then it's a percentage of the value of the land for the land crossing.
Many of them.
Is this a proposal from the trust fund working group?
Which part is the first part? So section one is, yes.
There aren't any further questions. Senator Ingraham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one. You referred to a monitoring fee. And also, are we... My question is, and maybe it's because I'm nearly brand new here, why we have fees described here, and then we have fees also described in rules. So there's quite a few fees involved here, then, more so than what I'm seeing now.
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, the... currently, there is the base application fee and a one-time fee that you pay that goes to the land class for your impact for crossing the land, crossing the water. We have looked at the issue of, are we fully recovering our cost for issuing these licenses and monitoring the construction on the land? The answer is no, we are not recovering the cost. And so under the governor's budget bill, so Section 2 comes from the governor's budget bill, but it's amending the same statute that Senator Saxhoff's bill did originally, is saying we need to recover those costs. And what we are going to do likewise is reduce what the general fund is otherwise paying to the Lands and Minerals Division to do the activity. So it's the user pay idea that we're going to have the party who's getting the utility license pay the full cost for the state agency work to issue them the license they get. And so we set it up with recognizing that the supplemental application fee is going to cover the basic cost, and in some cases we're going to need a monitoring cost. A lot of the water crossing licenses are very easy, and they go to a borehole underneath the water and they go back, or they cross on a bridge. But you also get some where they're doing trench work and damming work, and you're going to have to monitor it. And we also are a major transportation corridor for utilities from the Canada, from the Dakotas, from Montana, coming through Minnesota, through the Midwest area. And so we have a lot of oil and gas and some electricity that's coming through the state to the other parts of the country. And so as a major transportation corridor, we have these lines coming through. And we want to make sure that as they're crossing state lands and waters, it's done in an environmentally sound manner in accordance with the license we're issuing. So that's why there's a monitoring fee to make sure that's being done properly.
Senator Saxhoff moves that Senate File 121 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a couple of technical amendments I'd like to make. On the previously adopted A2 amendment, page 1, line 6, delete thereof and insert of the damages. And on page 1, line 7, delete may be And also on page 1, line 11, delete such and insert the. And on the bill.
What line was that? Oh, 11.
Line 11. On the bill, page 2, line 5, after the word with, insert an agency of. And then at the end of line 5, delete or any agency thereof. And on page 2, line 9, just delete such.
Okay. Everyone understand the Fredrickson Amendment? Technical. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Dill, did you have your hand up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm just wondering what the fees are going across lands that are not school trust lands.
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, the fee is the same for every land type, so it doesn't distinguish between the land types. But the school, only the public waters is for the school fund. That's the land. You can have school land, university land, consolidated conservation land, acquired land.
What if it's private land?
Mr. Chair, authority is only for utility licenses crossing lands under the control of the Commission of Natural Resources and Public Waters. So private land cannot be subject to this license.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Where's the PowerPoint?
Senator, okay. He's here. And Patrick is here.
Okay. Senator Bach, you come up, and I think they're going to set up a visual for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the department has an amendment for the bill. I don't know if somebody's here from the department to speak to it or not, but I believe Senate Council has it. So maybe
we'll pass that out.
We're getting a video ready. We could talk about the department's proposed amendment.
Okay.
We're doing Shades Building
or North Shore Drive.
We spent a lot of time in that first meeting.
This is a delete all author's amendment. Senator Fredrickson, would you like to move that? On the A1, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. So we're working off the A1.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could, the amendment starts on line 1.19. I guess 1.19 through 1.35, and it's in reference to the a segment of the Willard Munger Trail. There's some real confusion. The department can talk to it, can speak to the reason that they want to make a change and rename a portion of the Munger Trail. And then I'll speak to, once we get the video all set up, I'll speak to the rest of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Potter. Ron Potter with Parks and Trails, DNR. This amendment is to address some confusion, and as a result of, I think it was 2 years ago, we tried to combine the trail segments that make up essentially the Munger Trail system. The one that we're addressing, I believe you also have a map. It's called the Willard Munger Boundary Trail. Originally, it was called the Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Trail. And it was our original alignment running from Hinckley up to city of Cloquet and Duluth. And when the railroad abandoned that segment from Hinckley to Duluth, we picked that up as the non-motorized blacktop route. And then this other route, the Minnesota-Wisconsin boundary route, became just a snowmobile motorized route. And the Willard Munger system is essentially a non-motorized system. So what we're proposing is to take the Minnesota-Wisconsin boundary trail, rename it what was originally named, and then move it into the Arrowhead Trail system, which makes up the North Shore, the Taconite, and the Arrowhead State Trails, which are primarily natural surface snowmobile trails.
Could you explain where the, on the more zoomed in map, what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, committee, the alignment that we're talking about would be the alignment off to the right-hand edge of the map that runs from essentially St. Croix State Forest up into the Nemadji State Forest. And then on the left side of the map, you can see the dark line, which is the Munger Blacktop Trail that parallels I-35. So the trail that we would be proposing to move is the one that goes through the state forest. It's the natural surface route that is primarily a snowmobile trail.
Where do you want to move it to?
We just want to put it in. If the legislation moves it into sub 13, the Arrowhead Region trails, because those trails are all essentially natural surface, primarily snowmobile trails. So it would be consistent with the other trails in that section and would move it out of the Willard Munger section, which is primarily asphalt, non-motorized trails.
What you said that currently what is allowed on it now?
Right now it is primarily snowmobile. There are a couple segments up in the Nemadji that we have ATVs and dirt bikes on. But the primary use is snowmobile. There is some horse activity in the St. Croix.
I think, Mr. Chairman, the problem is there are really two Munger trails that run parallel to each other, and there's confusion on the part of the public that the one is really largely for snowmobiles and the other is what I think we all think of as the Munger Trail. And they run parallel to each other. So there's some confusion that there really are two Munger trails running parallel to each other.
Yes, but there's an expectation and a knowledge, and there's no confusion that this trail is non-motorized, except for snowmobiles in the winter.
Mr. Chairman.
And I think there's an expectation that this will remain the Willard Munger Trail. Has there been local discussion on changing the name of this?
Mr. Chairman, committee, the proposal is to change it back to what the name was originally. It was known as the Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Trail when it was originally authorized. There is other motorized activity on that in those as it goes through those state forests. Like I mentioned, there's some segments that are open to ATV currently. There are some segments that have dirt bikes on them.
There's only one small little leg that's ATV on that.
Correct. Up in the Nemadji, yes.
Right. Okay. And so that has there been local discussion on changing the name of this trail?
Mr. Chairman, there hasn't been any formal discussion with the communities up there. I'm not sure what communities that would be.
Senator Bach, I think you need to leave this proposal alone.
Sorry.
You know, let's bring it forward separately. Let's talk about your original bill.
Mr. Chairman, it's not my amendment.
I hear you. No, I hear
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair.
I didn't know anything about it until today.
I hear you. No, I hear you. Senator Stephen.
So I'm not, just to be clear, are there any alternate uses proposed, or is it just the name change? Senator Bach.
It's not my amendment, Senator. Yeah. Even the,
I mean, well, I, you know,
but you
we,
offered it.
You know what? We don't. You know, I think Senator Bach was offering a courtesy to the department, and so, and I don't want to open this can of worms because we only have until 5:30. We still have another bill. Let's. Why don't we? What do you want to do? Well, I don't think we should do. I don't. I think we should leave this. Just stick to the original bill that you
Mr.
had.
Mr. Chairman, somebody offered the A1 and put it on. I'm not on the committee, so I think you need to take it off if you want to get back to the original bill.
Mr. Knopf, what do we need to do?
Mr. Chairman, you just need somebody to vote on the prevailing side to reconsider that motion. Probably the author of the amendment might be the best person to do
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, having voted on the prevailing side, I would move that the vote whereby the A1 amendment was adopted be reconsidered.
Okay. You want to understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Chairman, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay. I think the – oh, yes, you had the amendment, so you withdraw. Okay, so we're back to the original Senate file 909.
Mr. Chairman, the proposal is to rename the North Shore Trail, which is a snowmobile trail. It is the snowmobile trail in the state that has the highest sled counts, the highest traffic. It has snow for a longer period of time than any trail in the state. Matter of fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you called up the Two Harbors or Silver Bay or Grand Marais, you find out that they got somewhere between a foot and 2 feet of snow this week. So the sled counts there are very, very high, and what this proposal does is it proposes to name it the C.J. Ramstead Trail. C.J. Ramstead is an icon in the sport of snowmobiling. He passed away 2 years ago in a car accident with his son. But there is a short video that I believe is on the Explore Minnesota website that talks a little bit about his life. But this is one of the publications that he pioneered and started. It's called Minnesota Snowmobiling. He did a number of other publications. I've been told that he's snowmobiled every place there's snow around the world. And he's in the Snowmobile Hall of Fame, and I haven't seen the video. I'm looking forward to seeing what we have on our Minnesota Explore Minnesota website about his life.
All right, let's play it.
Everywhere. I've ridden them in every snow state.
You haven't got the mic in the right place. You've got to have it right down by the...
And I even rode snowmobiles in the high Andes of South America. But I always enjoy coming back home to Minnesota because this is the best snow trip.
You've got to have it right. You've got to have it right up against the machine.
My name is C.J. Ramstead, and I've been riding snowmobiles for over 30 years. These are some of my favorite places to ride in Minnesota. Come on, let's take a look.
Take it off the stand.
Which way do you want to go? When there's snow on the ground in Minnesota, you can go practically anywhere on a snowmobile. There are over 20,000 miles of groomed and marked trails leading anywhere you want to go. You just have to decide. Savannah Portage State Forest because the trails curve around between the trees and up and around the cedar bogs, and there's big spruces and balsams and stuff here. It's just gorgeous. One of the things we have in Minnesota that makes our snowmobiling so great are long corridor trails like this one behind me. This one goes west of here about 50 miles. These trails are generally old rail grades that have been converted into snowmobile trails. We've got tunnels and bridges and everything it takes to make them into really good touring avenues for us to travel on. And they go from town to town, gives us an opportunity to go saddlebagging, which is something we invented here in Minnesota. Start in one town, ride all day, stay overnight in another town. One of the keys to spectacular snowmobiling is right here, a trail groomer. Over 250 snowmobile clubs are organized in Minnesota. They're set up to groom the trails, print maps, mark the corners, and they drive these big rigs to keep the trails nice and smooth. They have a $7 million budget, and they get it right every year. It's cool that all these snowmobile trails have trail maps because we can spend the evenings looking over the trail maps and imagining where we're going to go the next day. We'll get together and we'll pick out features along the trail where we might stop or places where we might want to take a picture or places where we might be able to ride for a long time without crossing a road. Well, we have an advantage in Minnesota in that we have all these lakes, and it's kind of what I call steady state riding, where you get out on a big lake and settling into a nice pace, 30, 40 miles an hour, and you're riding along with your friends, and it's like being a little fighter squadron, and the snow dust is coming off your skis, and the scenery moving by, and it's just a spectacular feeling, unlike anything else that I could think of. Well, there's nothing like snowmobiling. You can go anywhere on a snowmobile, and especially in Minnesota, and there's so much to see. There's so many interesting scenic places and so much backcountry. And a snowmobile just takes you there like a magic carpet.
I was telling staff that I was just kind of floating away watching that. Just like, oh, God, what time is it? Do I have any appointments tomorrow? Because I could just leave.
Chairman, I think there's probably a couple of weeks of snowmobiling left in northern Minnesota.
I know.
The North Shore Trail is...
Well, if people haven't had a chance to do that, it really is exactly what it was described as. You just think you're kind of tooling around on a motorized vehicle, but first of all, the machines have gotten so much quieter and so much less stinky than in prior days that it's just it's just kind of like you're tooling around and you'd be able to see things that you would never be able to see, and in the dead of winter, it's kind of the most mystical time you could do that. It's pretty incredible. And then to go through the woods to, you know, from lodge to lodge is a wonderful fun activity.
Mr. Chairman, it's a pretty neat way to see Minnesota's North Woods.
Yeah.
Because you see it in a way that you can't see it any other way. Mm-hmm. It's pretty neat. Get off the beaten track and see what the countryside looks like.
Yeah, it's amazing. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there's some folks from my community. One of my bow hunters that I think they were up there for 10 days. That's why he came back with a little frostbite. But I know they ended up ultimately in International Falls. But is there a connection across from Grand Marais? Can you connect by on snowmobile trail?
Yes, there is. There are two trails that I'm aware of that connect from the North Shore Trail that come into Ely. The Tomahawk Trail and the Yukon Trail that both connect up with the Taconite, which ultimately connects up with the Arrowhead that runs up to Canada in International Falls.
So they were just hit up.
It's a pretty incredible system we have. It's like a highway in that you have your maps, all the signs. And not only do you have signs, but there's markers. Mm-hmm. It's so I guess I can't compare it to other states. I've never done it in other states, but it's pretty amazing. And even on the lakes, it's like a well-marked highway. It's probably a better marked highway system than we've got. It's
well, Mr. Chairman, the
and only in Minnesota, two weekends ago, as my wife said, only in Minnesota could you go. You know, you're in the woods, and then you sled into the town of Ely, and you sled right up to the curb and then go to the restaurant. Only in Minnesota. Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to say that these are just these blue are only the permanent state snowmobile trails that are groomed by the state of Minnesota. Interconnecting all these are the snowmobile clubs who all have their own set of trails that they take care of and all have their own groomers. So that's what makes it.
Well, Mr. Chair, having said that, why I kind of like the name, the North Shore Trail. Why do we need to change it? And is North Shore Trail, is it only for snowmobiling?
Well, there certainly could accommodate other uses. It was built for snowmobiles. I mean, I'm sure there are people that out and walk on it in the summertime, but there are other trails along the North Shore that are non-motorized. For example, the Superior Hiking Trail runs also from Duluth to Grand Marais. That's a hiking trail. I have been trying for a number of years. We've been building little segments of a trail we call the Gitche-Gami Trail, which is also a non-motorized trail, but it's a hard surface trail that's going to run from Two Harbors to Grand Marais, about 80 miles. And we've been building segments of that as we've had pieces of federal money out of transportation bills. There's been, over the years, a number of provisions contained in the bonding bill to build out segments of the Gitche-Gami. Of course, that's much more expensive because it's hard surface.
Mr. Chair.
And then the North Shore, which is predominantly snowmobile. It's a pretty neat trail.
What happens to the trail during the summer? Is it just not used?
I guess is most of it grows up with grass on it. If it's like other snowmobile trails, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So it really is just a snowmobile trail.
I think that's the only published use we have for it.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, is there some reason that maybe it would be too long, but to not lose the North Shore either and just have it be the C.J. Ramstead Memorial North Shore Trail?
Or the North Shore / Ramstead Trail?
I think you need C.J. Ramstead. They might think it's Jim.
Yeah.
Okay. So what?
I mean, I'm Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with some combination of that, but I do think it would be kind of nice to recognize somebody that really is such an icon in the sport here in Minnesota that we have them on our Explore Minnesota website.
It's good.
Or maybe the Superior Hiking Trail could become the North Shore Trail, and then the snowmobile is Ramstead.
That could easily be done, I think.
Let's think about that between now and the next committee. Any other discussion? Does anyone want to testify in opposition to the bill? Opposition.
Jen?
You're fine.
Jen, are you going to
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I thought Senator Olson had a good idea to add North Shore.
If it's known as that, it doesn't confuse people. You still know it by that, but you add the extra plum of C.J. Ramstead Memorial to it as well. But
well, okay. All right.
That was my thinking.
Well, what we do on highways, you know, you have the highway number, and then you have a sign that says Memorial Highway, you know, Veterans Memorial Highway on the side.
Mr. Chair, it still gets known by the highway number, you know, as a route.
Right.
You don't rely on the memorial aspect of it is what it is, but it's there and people see it.
Okay.
It's been set aside by that.
Yeah.
But
maybe this could, I don't know, these are just permutations of what we could do just to preserve the North Shore. Maybe it could remain North Shore Trail, and then we could put up signs that say the C.J. Ramstead Memorial. Just different things to think about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you had a pretty good suggestion in just renaming the hiking trail the North Shore Trail if you want to do that. But I mean,
we should probably talk.
I don't think
hikers,
we have to decide
too.
Today.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, should I make the motion to Senate File 909 be moved or moved and sent to Environment
Finance. Yep. And if we could please work out something.
Does this one need to go there?
Pardon?
Does this need to go there?
I think so because there are fiscal implications on the maps and everything.
But it was all privately funded. It's
privately funded.
Oh, sure, trails.
We haven't.
Let's send it to finance. Let's let them look at it.
When they're privately funded, they usually haven't had to go to in other highways.
Let's give it another stop so we can think about these other things. All right. On the Saxog motion to recommend that Senate File 909 pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the Committee.
Senator Scheid, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your patience.
No, and actually, I've been down in the committee, and I've just been up here maybe 10 minutes, but I got to see the video, and I liked it, too.
Yeah.
Made me forget.
Thought about what we're going to do this weekend. That's a good thing.
It's beautiful. Mr. Chairman, and you have been so gracious, and your staff has been so gracious to give me a little more time. I think I've had some other bills and other conflicts, and so I think we've been scheduled a couple times. And the last time I was not feeling well at all. I'm feeling just fine, and here I am. And this is the Toxic Free Kids Act. I'm sure you've had here some bills that come in and ask the legislature, the state, to ban a certain chemical in a product. And we've had those bills. I have voted for that, but I've always felt a little uneasy because I'm not a scientist, and most of us aren't. We kind of know what we read or what we hear or hear a report on TV news or something, but you aren't sure what the chemical was. And, you know, we know about lead. That's a given, but most of us don't know a whole lot about more chemicals. We just, I think we know enough to be dangerous, you know. So I was kind of weary of having to make a decision about individual chemicals, and I thought we need a process in place that can help us, where scientists can weigh in, and through the state of Minnesota. And also we, some advocates brought a bill to me, and I jumped on it because I like the idea of a process instead of chemical by chemical asking us to make those decisions. And the original bill asks, and in fact, I think you have that language in front of you, is the original bill, 225, shows that the PCA, Pollution Control Agency, would be the entity that made the decisions and was responsible. I'm asking you to adopt the Delete Everything Amendment, and I will go through that and explain to you. This bill has been in health and housing. I don't know the whole name. I'm sorry. I guess it probably says on the original.
It's not the first stop anyway, so yes. let's go ahead and go through the amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members. And I think that committee felt pretty strongly, and the sentiment was that it probably should really center around the Department of Health, and it will have support from the Pollution Control Agency. So this amendment calls the agency the Pollution Control Agency, but if you look down at department on line 128, it says department means Department of Health. Okay? So there's definitions here. I want to let's see. Chemical of high concern on line 113 is important. A chemical identified on the basis of credible scientific evidence by a governmental entity or UN World Health Organization as being known or suspected with a high degree of probability to harm the normal development of a fetus or child or cause other developmental toxicity, cause cancer, genetic damage, or reproductive harm, disrupt the endocrine or hormone system, damage the nervous system, immune system, or organs, or cause other systemic toxicity, or be persistent bioaccumulative and toxic, or be very persistent and very bioaccumulative. That those are the chemicals that we are concerned about in this bill. And there's a definition in here of green chemistry that was asked for, I think, by Senator Hamm in the Health Committee. And that kind of gets us through to page 2. There on section 2, line 8, there it says, the Department of Health shall publish in the State Register and on the Department's Internet website a list of chemicals of high concern. And we just defined what those chemicals would be, not what they are, but what attributes they would have. And this is a list of entities that, and I'm looking forward to Mr. Sandusky from PCA speaking. I don't know that we need to be so prescriptive with the list, but we are in the beginning, and I think, well, I shouldn't speak for him, but I think that these are recognized entities that are reliable sources of information about toxic chemicals. Then we, on section 3, on page 3, line 15, we say that the Department of Health may designate a chemical of high concern as a priority chemical if they find, and then if it's in children's, if in a children's product that's offered for sale in Minnesota, it's been found through biomonitoring to be present in human blood, and there it lists the other bodily tissues and fluids. It's been found to be in household dust, indoor air, drinking water, or elsewhere in the home environment. May be present in fish, wildlife, or the natural environment. Has been identified as a high production volume chemical by the federal EPA, where it's been prohibited for use in another state within the United States. And we are asked that they designate at least 5 priority chemicals by 2011 and another 5 2 years later. There's the list that would be published at the bottom of page 3. And then we talk about the time frame, section 4, about disclosure of information on those chemicals. So I don't want to read every word here to you, but we ask we are asking people who manufacture or distribute children's product, and they know that it has one of these priority chemicals in it, to tell us if it's contained in the product and what its purpose is in the product. And then we look for safer alternatives, section 5. There may not be a safer alternative to some chemicals. I understand that. We understand that. But there may be. And if there is, then we ask that those products then, with the harmful chemical, the known harmful chemical, to no longer be distributed or sold in Minnesota, and that they move, and there's a time frame, and they move into selling something that is a safer alternative, that has a chemical or a substance of that is a safer alternative. So, let me see what else I have to tell you. We have some exemptions, and I think they aren't in the original bill, and I think they're found under applicability on page 7. We've said they do not apply to used children's products. This is line 7 and 12 is the applicability section. If they're not present in the final product, they're used in ag production, if they're used in motor vehicles or watercraft and their component parts, except that priority chemicals and detachable car seats is not exempt, it says here. I'm not sure. I may ask you, Kathleen, to explain that a little bit.
So what's left?
Well, there are toys and there are other children's products. There's, okay. maybe shampoo or lotion or other things that are used by children. So we are exempting we have pharmaceutical, it's important. This is the addition, I think, 7 pharmaceutical products and biologics, 8 medical devices, and then consumer electronics products. And then it lists lots of things that those chemicals may be found in, whether it's cameras or game consoles, printers.
Whatever,
you know, I think.
Don't have a lobbyist.
And then number 10, food and food or beverage packaging accepts a container that has baby food or infant formula in it. So, and then we ask for reports. And here we say the PCA, in conjunction with health, with the Commissioner of Health, will report. And we ask the agency, which is the PCA, remember, to enforce sections and have rulemaking authority on the last page 9, right before the effective date. Chairman, I think what's really important is that we establish a system, and this is still a work in progress, and I know there's a lot of detail in here. I don't know if all of that stays in terms of the list and those entities that are reliable sources for telling us what are chemicals of high concern and all of that, but the important thing is to set up a process and to begin doing this in a more rational way, I think, legislatively, than to do this chemical by chemical with bills year in and year out. So I think we want to have all of our products, obviously, to be safe. But I think particularly I'm focusing on children's products here and hope that you would keep us alive so we can, you know, keep working and working with the agency and the department, with the PCA, with the Department of Health, in trying to resolve some of the things. And I think Mr. Sandusky is going to testify. So, but if I could ask Ms. Schaefer perhaps to fill in where I have not.
Is there just a few questions, Senator Ingebrigtsen and then Olson?
Thank you, Matt. Mr. Chair, just so we are focused in on infant products here, is what we're talking about primarily. I see we've got.
Mr. Chairman, on page 1, yes, we are. The answer is we are focused on children's product, and that identifies what children's products are. Consumer product intended for use by children, such as baby products, toys, car seats, personal care products, and
under 12 years of age.
Okay, Mr. Chair, car seats as well as boat seats, I see you have here too. And I also noticed that in your last 3 sentences here, page 9, you want to report on all consumer products. So is that is that a little overreaching, or am I? That'd be the last page, page 9.
On
919.
On the delete all?
Yes.
I don't think it's on
report.
Delete all, but it might.
What am I looking at here?
No.
Looking at the
wrong
document
here. Senator Ingebrigtsen, are you talking about the reports on page 8?
Yes, line 26 on page 8. I think it says, we are asking them to report to the, you know, your committee and the Health Committee and the Commerce Committee regarding recommendations for evaluating and regulating in all consumer products. So, yes, we start with children's products, but we're asking for a report by January of 2012 to talk about other products as well.
Senator,
but they won't have analyzed all products.
Just one follow-up, if I could. Are there other states doing something like this? Are they considered their efforts at all, or are we the only one? You know?
I think some of the additional testimony is going to answer that. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Scheid. I don't know if you've been following some of the supposedly unintended consequences of the Consumer Product Safety Act that involving lead at the federal level that has been carried to such, the agency has carried it to such far extremes that if there's some
little part in a bike that the kid would never chew on, that they've had to pull them off the shelves and can't sell, and there's various parts and things. I mean, there's been a lot of brouhaha over that, just because there's the word "any" was in there and there was no description or definition. It seems like I don't know if you've taken some guidance from that, but that you at least make some clarity as to what areas it might not apply, so that we don't go so far reaching we put everybody out of business. And
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, and I hadn't heard that about lead, but
oh my.
I mean, I know it occurs naturally as well. I mean, there is sometimes you can't get away from it, so you have to be aware of that. Because we know how harmful it is if it's ingested.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Scheid, it was involved. They found they have to analyze every single product that goes into anything. It involved children's clothes. It went to everything, and there's no way that people could afford to it. And so it was taking things off the shelves it's been rather widely determined. I mean, certainly we agree with the goal of getting lead off of it, but how you word legislation can have some far-reaching effects if it isn't carefully crafted, and it appears you're working in that direction to have clarity and to try not to go beyond the pale in terms of what we're trying to manage.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Chairman, my goal is to establish a process with the experts making the decisions rather than legislators deciding what's good or bad and how much, if any, and saying things like none and all or any. So Ms. Schaefer would like to say something, if she may.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kathleen Schuler.
I'm sorry.
I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm co-director of Healthy Legacy. And I could begin by trying to answer your question, Senator Olson. The Consumer Product Safety Commission bill that was just passed, I know there's a lot of concern about it. And I know that congressional reps, including Senator Klobuchar, are working on trying to clarify that. In our particular piece of legislation, the department will have to do rulemaking. Also, the manufacturers that have these chemicals in their products need to also report on exposures, so that if there's a particular product where a child would not be exposed, they can provide that information to the agency, and the agency would evaluate that. So the agency would have discretion. They wouldn't, or they could set a quantity of a chemical, or they could not. They could determine how to best enforce that. I'm going to be really brief in my testimony because you heard me before. It was a while ago. And I hope you remember Dr. John Peterson Meyer's testimony. And his testimony was very powerful because the science of low-dose early life exposures with children is very, very powerful. And we're trying to reduce those exposures and avoid those exposures. So this particular bill, it's not trying to ban a bunch of chemicals. It's basically setting up a process for assessing chemicals. And to answer your question, Senator Ingebrigtsen, there are other states, including Maine and Washington, that have similar frameworks. California has a framework that's a little bit different, that look at chemicals of high concern and then priority chemicals, the ones that are found in the human body, the ones that are in kids' products. And the first list, the chemicals of high concern, is about 1,500 chemicals. We're not talking about thousands of chemicals. The second list, the chemicals of priority chemicals that are found in children's products in the human body and in the environment, is between 50 and 80 chemicals. And then we're asking the agencies to pick five of those and then evaluate whether or not there are safer alternatives. So a chemical can't be regulated unless there is a safer alternative, because we're trying to avoid unnecessary exposures. The other thing that this bill does is it helps move industries. There's a lot of industries that are moving in the direction of green chemistry. They're really focusing on that, and they're trying to do the best thing for the environment and public health. But this actually provides an extra impetus to move in the direction of safer chemicals and green chemistry. And I'll be happy to answer any additional questions that you have.
Are folks comfortable just adding the delete all to the bill? Be all right? Okay. So want to move the A6?
I'll move the A6, Mr. Chair.
You have a flurry of volunteers.
Mr. Getting worse. Chairman, I,
Senator Olson has not had the opportunity today.
She I moves. Yield to Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just say essentially this transfers, kind of reverses the roles of the Department of Health and the PCA, and I think that they agree, I think it's safe to say they agree that that's the way that should be. If this were to, you know, make it through and become law, that's the way it should be. And then we've added some things to the exemption, things that are, to which it's not applicable. So.
On the A6, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Who else? Senator Frederickson, you had your hand up.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, I've heard you say that this is kind of a work in progress and a process. How are stakeholders going to be involved in this process? Will it be only through the rulemaking process, or how do you get everybody involved in this that needs to be involved, the manufacturers and retailers and others?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I thought at first you were talking about the, when I said a work in process, I actually meant the bill. It's a work in process trying to develop a process.
Yeah. So there's two meetings.
I've certainly been talking to manufacturers and people who manufacture children's products and medical device people, the biologics, some of those people, electronics, those things are reflected in the amendment. Those are people that I've worked with, you know, and talked to. I know that there are people who are still concerned, people who do a lot of personal care products and that sort of thing for children, for infants and children. And I know there's some concern there, and I think you'll hear some testimony about kind of just a general concern. But I think, you know, there is another bill going through that would have a council that's made up of appointed people like the representing industry. To be really honest with you, I don't really want to do that. Because at the end of the day, you still have the legislature then. If they don't move, they get bogged down, then you still have the legislature maybe having to make a decision about yet another chemical. And I'd rather see the scientists that, you know, work for the state of Minnesota, who know what lists to use, what clearinghouses to use, what information is valid and would be of concern in terms of, in this case, children's products and then going forward, other products. But, yeah, I'm guessing. Mr. Sandusky maybe could speak to that rulemaking a little bit about industry and what. I'm sure they'd be involved in, because they'd be actually required to give information. And
Chairman, Senator, sorry, I was just curious if you envision like a stakeholders group working on this also, other than just the rulemaking part, because I know rulemaking is a very set process. Everybody has a chance to submit testimony.
Senator Shea?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I haven't really considered what role, for example, an advisory group within this bill. I'm not really wanting to go in that direction, but I certainly want input. I mean, I don't want to do this in a vacuum without the concerns of manufacturers and certain industries.
Thank you.
Being addressed.
Do you have an additional testimony, Senator?
Chairman, I don't. I think Mr. Sandusky would like. I mean,
okay. Come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mike Sandusky, Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency. I'll try to be brief here. Let me provide some context. Senator Scheid sent some things that are absolutely true. The reason you've seen chemical by chemical approaches to banning is basically because there is a failure at the federal level to regulate toxics and products. And I know a lot about that. I will not bore you with that. But certainly TSCA legislation and other federal legislation has failed us in some regards. So there is a need here is what I'm totally agreeing with. But I'm going to try to do this as well as I can. Let me propose to you that the second report that's required, that's already been referenced, is a more strategic approach to the problem than the bill that you're seeing today. That does set up, makes an obligation for the Department of Commerce, the Pollution Control Agency, as well as the Department of Health to divine a structure and a framework for regulating toxics in products and green chemistry as well. So I think the bill is a little bit cart before the horse. I know the senator knows how I feel about that. I also think the landscape that you need to consider as policymakers is if you have your ear to the ground like folks at the Department of Health and my agency have, the impetus for regulatory reform at the national level is real. I don't like saying this because for the past several years we just haven't made a lot of progress. So I don't like saying it, but I do believe that there's a lot of traction. So that's something for you to consider. And then finally, very specifically, today, even some of the members of the committee in this room have received within the past couple of days an invitation to Senator Fredrickson, a stakeholder process to ask relevant, salient questions about divining and devising a strategic approach to this issue as well as others of risk. And if you'll just give me a second, let me refer to a couple of the questions that a group of stakeholders are going to be asked to respond to. These aren't the exact questions, but they're close. What should be the goals for Minnesota-specific regulation of chemicals? Which policy options are best to achieve those goals? To what extent can Minnesota rely on existing or reasonably anticipated federal or international regulatory reform policy regarding chemicals? Do state agencies and boards possess the resources and procedural vehicles to respond to these deficiencies, and are the responsibilities distributed among state and municipal agencies in an integrated way? So on and so forth. I'm not going to bore you with all of that, but there are some very strategic questions that a lot of stakeholders are going to be asked to provide input to. Basically, what I'm respectfully suggesting is, yes, there's a need. There's a need for specifically in this area of toxics in children's products, but I'm respectfully proposing to you that there's a more strategic way to attack this problem and embrace stakeholder input like the state of California and others are doing now.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Sandusky, Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Sandusky and Senator Scheid, I'm looking on page 3 of your Delete All Amendment, and I'm reminded of the California Clean Fuel Act. And Mr. Sandusky just mentioned California. But if you look at Section 3, which is Identification of Priority Chemicals, starting on line 316, the Department of Health may designate a chemical of high concern as a priority chemical if the department finds. And, of course, it just says, it says may. But it, as you go down the list here, on number one, the chemical is contained in a children's product. Okay, well, we've got very good testing abilities now to find chemicals, so that's not going to be a problem, finding some chemical in a children's product. And then the word and on line 3.19, and you go down to 2, 3, 4. Each one of those lines starts, the chemical has been found, the chemical has been found, the chemical has been found. Well, we know we're going to find it because we have very good testing capabilities. So that's not a problem. Then you get down to number 5. The chemical has been identified as a high production volume chemical by the federal EPA. That's probably not a problem either. But then you get down to line 3.27, and there's that word or at the end of the line. And, that, and then it gets into this California issue where it says the sale or use of the chemical or product containing the chemical has been prohibited in another state within the United States. So it seems to me we're putting a lot of stock in what some other state does, and I'm not sure we want to do that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, that's actually why maybe you don't want to have that line in the bill, but I think it's better to go through a process with scientists, work for the state, rather than having the legislature decide, well, you know, they banned this in California. yeah, and therefore we should do it. This just says they may do it. First of all, it has to be found in a children's product. That's the first. That's a must, I think. And it looks like one of the other, I should say looks like it, or, and one of the other listed items here. Now, if it's in a children's product and it's been banned in California, I'm guessing that our scientists would look at the scientific reasoning that went into that decision in California and decide either that it was valid or not. I don't know, Mr. Sandusky, is that kind of what you agree?
Mr.
Chairman. Sandusky.
Senator, let me try this. The first two sections of the bill, let me describe them very generically. They ask, and in this case, it's actually the Department of Health, very appropriately, so I believe they're in the audience, so they might want to speak to this. They're asked to look at and search through a number of lists that are listed in the legislation, peer-reviewed research, to come up with a body of chemicals that are of some concern. And then with the addition of this section, the presence of those chemicals being found in these media or parts of the environment, then the real regulatory introspection takes place in this bill. Fundamentally, there's nothing really wrong with that. What I'm saying is we're not testing anything in this bill. This bill relies on lists and peer-reviewed research that exists today.
Mr. Chair.
Santil, then we should get moving.
Except if some legislature in some other state decides that something's not good, then you've got these two sentences in here. It triggers, you're putting some stock in that.
Yeah, I mean, Senator Dill, it doesn't trigger the listing, it just recognizes it. It just says you may designate it if it happened in another state. It doesn't say that it will happen. But yeah, if another state does it, we should put some stock in that, don't you think, to consider? That's all it's saying.
I think the upper ones are better than that one.
Mr. Quellis?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce this evening, and also a coalition of people including, and if you'll bear with me, the American Chemistry Council, the Toy Industry Association, the Minnesota Beverage Association, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Can Manufacturers Institute, Consumer Specialty Products Association, the Personal Care Products Association, the Midwest Food Processors, Minnesota Retailers Association, Abbott Laboratories, the Infant Formula Council, Johnson & Johnson, and 3M. Okay, so now we know when we talk about the chemicals of 1,500 that we were talking about on that list, why those people are all concerned. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, we agree with the proposal by Senator Scheid that there has to be a process in place. There is no doubt about that. We're not going to argue that. We just have a difference on where that process should take place. We think it should take place on the federal level. Yes, there had been a failure there, but just recently, now under this administration, Representative Waxman has moved forward on the Energy and Commerce Committee and has already started hearings updating TSCA, which is the Toxic Substance Control Act. It updates it, modernizes it, and restructures it, and that is supported by industry. He's already had one hearing on that, and that's moving forward. Additionally, on the federal budget bill that the president just signed, there was a substantial increase in there for the EPA to increase regulation, research, and enforcement to move forward on these products. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sandusky referenced, and along the lines of what Senator Fredrickson was talking about, I did receive the letter on Tuesday from, ironically, former State Senator Steve Kelly, who is over at the University of Minnesota, Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy. He is putting together a work group to facilitate a discussion about a broad stakeholder process, which needs to take into a stakeholder process what they ought to explore, the scope of the process, and possibly come back with conclusions. So we would prefer to go through that route, if not a federal route. And if we're going to talk about something, and it's also been referenced here this evening, was Senator Saltzman's Senate File 618, which would set up an advisory council. If you would think along the lines of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, where business and industry get together, make recommendations, and come to the legislature. So those are the comments that we'd like to put forth this evening, Mr. Chairman. We've met with Senator Scheid. She's been She's been very cordial in us towards us and trying to schedule some meetings back and forth, obviously, with the way things are going. We know that this is a work in progress. We're hoping to still keep the relationship that we've got going and keep talking. That's my comments, Mr. Chairman. I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Quiles. Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wish I had a nickel for every time industry was in front of us saying, well, let's just wait for the feds to act. The reason the feds act is because the states begin to take action. That's the way our system was conceived and set up. And, you know, as much as I love Henry Waxman, really glad he is where he is. And I love this new administration. They're fantastic. You know, I'm excited about what I see. We still have a role as state policymakers, state legislators, to try to come up with the best ideas we can come up with inside the boundaries of our state. Ultimately, enough states get same or similar ideas or get contradictory ideas or, you know, compete for the best idea. That eventually gives rise to federal activity, federal action to step into this policy area and begin. Likewise with, you know, Senator Kelly, good friend of mine, talk to him regularly. One of the brightest minds we've ever had around here. But clearly, you know, things like that get moving at the university because they see policy action being taken somewhere, you know, and that's the tool that we have available to us as policymakers.
Mr. Quiles, have the stakeholders not been involved in this bill?
We have had, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have had some discussions with Senator Scheid, some very preliminary discussions. I have yet to go through. I have to go through the delete, everything. There's some concessions to some members of the coalition, but I have not had a chance to go through all of it. But we have not been involved at all in the makeup of this bill, sir. No.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Quiles, is there any child product, protection advocates on your board, on the board that you're talking about calling? Part of this is about child protection and about protecting kids and the chemicals, and if we're only talking to those chemical manufacturers at this and scientists that are involved in the chemical industry without talking to the people that are advocating for the protection of these products having a place at that table, it seems like we're going to get a, jaded view of what can come out. So that's first question, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, agreed. That's why I think that the proposal that Senator Kelly, former Senator Kelly, I agree with Senator Dibble, one of the brightest minds I think that's been in this body, that he's got going forward involves a wide range of people, and we would value that input as we move forward in establishing that process. Second of all, referencing the Senator Saltzman bill, Senate File 618, that puts up a makeup of 9 people appointed by the governor, the House, and the Senate involving scientists, environmental advocacy groups, as well as business representatives. So there would be input from both sides of the issue, if you will. Towards reaching a conclusion.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Quiles, or Senator Scheid, what I see in this bill is that as many things are defined in it, there's also a great deal of flexibility in how the PCA develops this on their own as they bring it through. And yes, the process that Mr. Sandusky said, the second report has probably better merit, but this gets it so that it's moving through the process, I think, rather than being, and maybe the date that it's enacted is something that needs to be worked on. But what I see is this is process that you're describing is still within this bill. It may be ahead of it in some of the definitions, but the process is still in the bill. So I'm not sure who's jumping the gun on it as far as whether Senator Scheid is, but to me it will create that kind of discussion within the PCA and the Health Department. So
this does need to go to Judiciary next. Mm-hmm. Senator Scheid, final comments?
Mr. Chairman, just that I'll keep working, and I don't know exactly where I'd plug in the consultation and or, you know, receiving input on the process itself, meaning the process that I'm trying to establish in here for determining chemicals of high concern. But I'm not adverse to listening to what everybody has to say, and I'm hoping that we will be able to go to the meeting that Mr. Sandusky described, and I'm willing to do that and entertain the possibility that we will have some way for that, for those organizations to have input here into how the process might work better.
Well, I asked kind of at the outset of the hearing, when you went through your list of exemptions, what's left? So, I mean, there's a huge list of exemptions. So Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I have one very short amendment that I'd like to move the bill. On page 8, line 5, delete such.
Pardon me. Such. Sorry, I missed the line.
Chairman, Senator Scheid, page 8, line 5, delete such. It's superfluous.
So,
everyone understand that amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think
Dibble.
Senator Scheid didn't succeed at sneaking that such by. Try as she did.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 225 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary.
Okay. We understand the motion. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that we should move it on, but I'm not sure I'm willing to move it on with the word with recommended to pass. I'd like to move it to the next committee without recommendation to pass, because I don't think this thing is really ready to pass yet. There's more work that needs to be done on it. And Senator Scheid has also said she needs to do more work on it.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I guess it's going to a number of committees, and I think if you look at the concern of the committee, and if you feel I haven't addressed the things you'd be concerned about here, that would be one way of looking at it and not recommending it to pass. But I think, that the work that remains to be done, I know it's going to business, industry, and jobs as well, and, I'm going to have to really have my gloves on that day.
It's got a long way to go, yeah. Senator Dill, and I mean the question for this committee is this good environmental policy, and if we don't like these, if we consider the bills to ban chemicals that we hear periodically to be, if we feel that those are somewhat indiscriminate, then this is what we need to do as far as environmental policy. And have scientists look at them and consider them. That's how I see this as environmental policy. It doesn't ban any chemicals. And if you're concerned about the various bills to ban chemicals, then this is the proper alternative.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, Bill? Mr. Sandusky of the PCA and Tony Quillis of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce both indicated that they are not endorsing these bills yet. There needs to be more work done on them. And so, since this is an environmental issue, it seems like if we had enough time, we would ask Senator Scheid to bring her bill back after she's been through a few more committees to see what it looks like. So the least we can do is send it out of here without recommendation and let's see what happens as it moves along.
I'm comfortable with the motion before us. We can see how it goes, and if we need to have an alternative motion, I guess we can do that. Further discussion on the Frederickson motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Shire, for your patience. Thank you, members, for a lot of good work today.
I think it fell down. It was laying right here, so I'm going to leave it lay right there. Oh, here's a washer, too. Now we're starting to put stuff together here.